Chapter 63. The king, when he received Oliver's warning, made his escape from Hampton Court. After some indecision and uncertainty, he went to Carisbrooke Castle in the Isle of Wight. At first, he was pretty free there, but, even there, he carried on a pretended treaty with the Parliament, while he was really treating with commissioners from Scotland, to send an army into England to take his part. When he broke off this treaty with the Parliament, having settled with Scotland, and was treated as a prisoner, his treatment was not changed too soon, for he had plotted to escape that very night to a ship sent by the Queen, which was lying off the island. He was doomed to be disappointed in his hopes from Scotland. The agreement he had made with the Scottish commissioners was not favorable enough to the religion of that country, to please the Scottish clergy, and they preached against it. The consequence was, that the army raised in Scotland and sent over, was too small to do much, and that, although it was helped by a rising of the Royalists in England, and by good soldiers from Ireland, it could make no head against the parliamentary army under such men as Cromwell and Fairfax. The king's eldest son, the Prince of Wales, came over from Holland with 19 ships, a part of the English fleet having gone over to him, to help his father, but nothing came of his voyage, and he was fain to return. The most remarkable event of this second civil war was the cruel execution by the parliamentary general of Sir Charles Lucas and Sir George Lisle, two grand royalist generals, who had bravely defended Colchester under every disadvantage of famine and distress for nearly 3 months. When Sir Charles Lucas was shot, Sir George Lisle kissed his body, and said to the soldiers who were to shoot him, "Come near, and make sure of me." "Apostrophe I warrant you, Sir George, apostrophe," said one of the soldiers, "we shall hit you." "Apostrophe eh?" "Apostrophe," he returned with a smile, "but I have been nearer to you, my friends, many a time, and you have missed me." Apostrophe, the Parliament, after being fearfully bullied by the army who demanded to have 7 members whom they disliked given up to them but voted, that they would have nothing more to do with the king. On the conclusion, however, of this second civil war, which did not last more than 6 months, they appointed commissioners to treat with him. The king, then so far released again, as to be allowed to live in a private house at Newport in the Isle of Wight, managed his own part of the negotiation with a sense that was admired by all who saw him, and gave up, in the end, all that was asked of him, even yielding which he had steadily refused, so far, to the temporary abolition of the bishops, and the transfer of their church land to the crown. Still, with his old fatal vice upon him, when his best friends joined the commissioners in beseeching him to yield all those points as the only means of saving himself from the army, he was plotting to escape from the island. He was holding correspondence with his friends and the Catholics in Ireland, though declaring that he was not, and he was writing, with his own hand, that in what he yielded he meant nothing but to get time to escape. Matters were at this pass when the army, resolved to defy the Parliament, marched up to London. The Parliament, not afraid of them now, and boldly led by Hollis, voted that the king's concessions were sufficient ground for settling the peace of the kingdom. Upon that, Colonel Rich and Colonel Pride went down to the House of Commons with a regiment of horse soldiers and a regiment of foot, and Colonel Pride, standing in the lobby with a list of the members who were obnoxious to the army in his hand, had them pointed out to him as they came through, and took them all into custody. This proceeding was afterwards called by the people, for a joke, Pride's Perch. Cromwell was in the north, at the head of his men, at the time, but when he came home, approved of what had been done. What with imprisoning some members and causing others to stay away, the army had now reduced the House of Commons to some 50 or so. He soon voted that it was treason in a king to make war against his parliament and his people, and sent an ordinance up to the House of Lords for the king's being tried as a traitor. The House of Lords, then 16 in number, to a man rejected it. Thereupon, the commons made an ordinance of their own, that they were the supreme government of the country, and would bring the king to trial. The king had been taken for security to a place called Hurst Castle, a lonely house on a rock in the sea, connected with the coast of Hampshire by a rough road 2 miles long at low water. Thence, he was ordered to be removed to Windsor. Thence, after being but rudely used there, and having none but soldiers to wait upon him at table, he was brought up to St. James Palace in London, and told that his trial was appointed for next day. On Saturday, the 20th of January, 1649, this memorable trial began. The House of Commons had settled that 135 persons should form the court, and these were taken from the house itself, from among the officers of the army, and from among the lawyers and citizens. John Bradshaw, sergeant at law, was appointed president. The place was Westminster Hall. At the upper end, in a red velvet chair, sat the president, with his hat lined with plates of iron for his protection, on his head. The rest of the court sat on side benches, also wearing their hats. The king's seat was covered with velvet, like that of the president, and was opposite to it. He was brought from St. James to Whitehall, and from Whitehall he came by water to his trial. When he came in, he looked round very steadily on the court, and on the great number of spectators, and then sat down. Presently he got up and looked round again. On the indictment against Charles Stuart, for high treason, apostrophe being read, he smiled several times, and he denied the authority of the court, saying that there could be no parliament without a House of Lords, and that he saw no House of Lords there. Also, that the king ought to be there, and that he saw no king in the king's right place. Bradshaw replied that the court was satisfied with its authority, and that its authority was God's authority and the kingdom's. He then adjourned the court to the following Monday. On that day, the trial was resumed, and went on all the week. When the Saturday came, as the king passed forward to his place in the hall, some soldiers and others cried for justice. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and execution on him. That day too, Bradshaw, like an angry sultan, wore a red robe, instead of the black robe he had worn before. The king was sentenced to death that day. As he went out, one solitary soldier said, "God bless you, sir." Apostrophe, apostrophe, for this, his officer struck him. The king said he thought the punishment exceeded the offense. The silver head of his walking stick had fallen off while he leaned upon it, at one time of the trial. The accident seemed to disturb him, as if he thought it ominous of the falling of his own head, and he admitted as much. Now it was all over. Being taken back to Whitehall, he sent to the House of Commons, saying that as the time of his execution might be nigh, he wished he might be allowed to see his darling children. It was granted. On the Monday he was taken back to St. James, and his two children then in England, the Princess Elizabeth 13 years old, and the Duke of Gloucester 9 years old, were brought to take leave of him, from Sion House, near Brentford. It was a sad and touching scene, when he kissed and fondled those poor children, and made a little present of 2 diamond seals to the princess, and gave them tender messages to their mother who little deserved them, for she had a lover of her own whom she married soon afterwards, and told them that he died for the laws and liberties of the land. Apostrophe, I am bound to say that I don't think he did, but I dare say he believed so. There were ambassadors from Holland that day, to intercede for the unhappy king, whom you and I both wish the Parliament had spared, but they got no answer. The Scottish commissioners interceded too. So did the Prince of Wales, by a letter in which he offered as the next heir to the throne, to accept any conditions from the Parliament. So did the Queen, by letter likewise. Notwithstanding all, the warrant for the execution was this day signed. There is a story that as Oliver Cromwell went to the table with the pen in his hand, to put his signature to it, He drew his pen across the face of one of the commissioners, who was standing near, and marked it with ink. That commissioner had not signed his own name yet, and the story adds that, when he came to do it, he marked Cromwell's face with ink in the same way. The king slept well, untroubled by the knowledge that it was his last night on earth, and rose on the 30th of January, 2 hours before day, and dressed himself carefully. He put on 2 shirts lest he should tremble with the cold, and had his hair very carefully combed. The warrant had been directed to 3 officers of the army, Colonel Hacker, Colonel Hunks, and Colonel Fayre. At 10 o'clock, the first of these came to the door, and said it was time to go to Whitehall. The king, who had always been a quick walker, walked at his usual speed through the park, and called out to the guard, with his accustomed voice of command, "March on the pace!" When he came to Whitehall, he was taken to his own bedroom, where a breakfast was set forth. As he had taken the sacrament, he would eat nothing more, but, at about the time when the church bells struck 12 at noon, for he had to wait, through the scaffold not being ready, he took the advice of the good Bishop Juxon who was with him, and ate a little bread, and drank a glass of claret. Soon after he had taken this refreshment, Colonel Hacker came to the chamber with the warrant in his hand, and called for Charles Stuart. And then, through the long gallery of Whitehall Palace, which he had often seen light, and gay and merry and crowded, in very different times, the fallen king passed along, until he came to the center window of the banqueting house, through which he emerged upon the scaffold, which was hung with black. He looked at the 2 executioners, who were dressed in black and unmasked. He looked at the troops of soldiers on horseback and on foot, and all looked up at him in silence. He looked at the vast array of spectators, filling up the view beyond, and turning all their faces upon him. He looked at his old palace of St. James, and he looked at the block. He seemed a little troubled to find that it was so low, and asked if there were no place higher? Then, to those upon the scaffold, he said that it was the Parliament who had begun the war, and not he, but he hoped they might be guiltless too, as ill instruments had gone between them. In one respect, he said, he suffered justly, and that was because he had permitted an unjust sentence to be executed on another. In this, he referred to the Earl of Strafford. He was not at all afraid to die, but he was anxious to die easily. When someone touched the axe, while he was speaking, he broke off and called out, "Take heed of the axe! Take heed of the axe!" He also said to Colonel Hacker, "Take care that they do not put me to pain." He told the executioner, "I shall say but very short prayers, and then thrust out my hands as the sign to strike." He put his hair up, under a white satin cap which the bishop had carried, and said, "I have a good cause and a gracious God on my side." The bishop told him that he had but 1 stage more to travel in this weary world, and that, though it was a turbulent and troublesome stage, it was a short one, and would carry him a great way all the way from earth to heaven. The king's last word, as he gave his cloak and the George the decoration from his breast to the bishop, was, "Remember." He then kneeled down, laid his head on the block, spread out his hands, and was instantly killed. One universal groan broke from the crowd, and the soldiers, who had sat on their horses, and stood in their ranks immovable as statues, were of a sudden all in motion, clearing the streets. Thus, in the 49th year of his age, falling at the same time of his career as Strafford had fallen in his, perished Charles I. With all my sorrow for him, I cannot agree with him that he died the martyr of the people, for the people had been martyrs to him, and to his ideas of a king's rights, long before. Indeed, I am afraid that he was but a bad judge of martyrs, for he had called that infamous Duke of Buckingham the martyr of his sovereign. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.